When you read the life of Christ, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you might not have ever noticed this before, might not have ever paid attention, but the Sermon on the Mount is a good place to illustrate how Jesus used the word Father. He not only used the word Father, he used the word Father several times. If you were, before you go to bed tonight or sometime this week, read through Matthew 5, 6, and 7, or just read through Matthew chapter 6, and notice how in that sixth chapter of Matthew, and really throughout that Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about Father, 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 Father. Now, I've done that, but until this week, there was a point that had escaped me. If I had been a Jew, and I had been listening to Jesus give that sermon, and in that short amount of time, just Matthew chapter 6, and I had heard him say, Father, 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 I probably would have been scratching my head. You see, as you go back to the Old Testament, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, I had not. How many times in the Old Testament do you find God referred to as Father? Now, I didn't have the time to go and try to check out every reference to Father, but there have been some people who have tried to do that. One estimate is there are only 7 times, just 7 times in the Old Testament where God is referred to as Father. Another estimate went a little higher. They suggested that there were only 10, just 10 passages in the Old Testament where God is referred to as Father. Now, if you're a Jew, and you are hearing God described in the synagogue in various ways, but you almost never, ever hear him referred to as Father. And then one day Jesus shows up and he begins teaching, and he begins to refer to God as Father repeatedly in that same lesson. You probably would have wondered, who are you? What kind of teaching is this? That is very strange compared to the years of synagogue teaching. Now, all these references to Father probably would have been even a little more stunning had the people gone back and considered the Ark of the Covenant. If you were not with us last week, we introduced the Ark of the Covenant. We have a monitor down tonight, so I apologize for that, but you're going to have to direct your attention to my left. One of the attention-getting features as far as the Ark was the cherubim. Last week, and we've studied this out before, the cherubim were basically guardians of God's holiness. God does not need guardians for his holiness, but this is the function that they serve. Some have, and I think this is a good comparison, some have compared the angels who are the cherubim to some kind of an enforcement angel. Now, I'm not going to go this direction, but I do think it's interesting that if angels escort not just the righteous to Hades, we know that because of Luke chapter 16, but if angels escort the unrighteous to Hades, isn't it thought-provoking to consider that maybe it's the cherubim who escort the unrighteous to the Hadean realm? So I don't know if that's true or not, but that is, at least in my mind, a possibility. As you look at this ark and you see the two cherubim on top of the ark, you find that they were definitely part of the ark. And we've got some passages here. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 4, at least twice in the Old Testament, 1 Samuel 4:4, and then a second reference, 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 15, you find there in those two verses, the Bible says that God sits above the cherubim. Well, certainly as you think about, if we can picture God as far as a physical realm, if we try to get an understanding of what God is, that would certainly be true. But if you think about 1 Samuel 4:4 and 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 15 in terms of the ark, that I think helps us understand a little bit more about the ark and causes us to ask a few more questions about the ark. You can't see it very well, but I've got a line coming straight down to indicate at the top of the ark you've got this seat. And this seat, of course, was known as the mercy seat. You may remember from the Day of Atonement, your studies of the Old Testament, that once a year, the high priest goes into the most holy place, that inner spot, and he goes and he puts some animal blood on this mercy seat. This was a sin offering. Now, as you look at this picture, and you consider what I just mentioned as far as the high priest going in once a year, where is the blood being put? It is being put on the lid area, the top area of this ark. And who or what is looking down at the blood? Well, the cherubim are. And who or what are the cherubim? They are the enforcement angels for God's holiness. You can begin to piece some things together, and hopefully we'll make some more connections before the night is done. Now, had I been a Jew, and I had been aware of all this stuff, I couldn't see it. Obviously, I'm not a high priest in this illustration, but there's this high priest, and it's once a year, and the cherubim are looking down on that. I might not have felt all that comfortable. I would have been thinking, well, okay, there is this sin offering, but how often is that going to be made for me? At least this particular offering, this is going to be made just once per year. And as a Jew, I'm thinking, this offering that's being made once per year, who or what is looking on? We've got these cherubim, which, again, they are gold. They're not living there on the ark, obviously. But they are looking on. And going back to 1 Samuel chapter 4, 4 and 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 15, perhaps I'm also aware of those Old Testament passages, and I'm thinking that God is described, he's certainly all places, but there is pictured as far as God having this special presence there. He is there in the area of the cherubim. Now here's where I want to go with that. Skipping to the New Testament in just a minute, let's think about John the Baptist's father. You may remember from the first chapter of Luke some information about John's dad. The time has come for John's dad, he was a priest, and it was time for him to go to the temple. And John's dad on this occasion was going to burn some incense. You remember that as John, his dad goes in, there are several things that take place, and John's dad is delayed. And there was a reaction by the people because John's dad was delayed. Now, if you're a Jew, you're thinking about all the things that I've just laid out, and here is someone who goes in to make an offering to God, and there is this priest in there, and he's not coming out at the expected time. What do you think you're going to be thinking? Well, I suspect that most people are going to be thinking maybe something didn't go all that well. Maybe he somehow violated God's will, and maybe God has struck him dead because this is a very serious matter. As you read through that, you find that in Luke chapter 1 and verse 10, the people were praying during this time. I suspect that some of those prayers were, God, may things go well as far as the offering that's being made. If the priests were delayed, again, it would have been a very natural conclusion that something has gone wrong and he has been killed by God. How are we going to get him out of there? Now, adding to this a little bit more, if you go back to the book of Exodus and you read Exodus chapter 39, verses 25 and 26, you find that as far as the clothing of the high priest, there were some bells on the high priest's clothing. Now, if you have done some fishing in the past, this may not be as common as it once was, but I remember going up, there were some people, they would attach a bell to the fishing rod. Maybe they go off and eat lunch, or maybe some kids were going to go off and play, and they had that bell attached to the rod because that bell would tinkle or that bell would jingle and let them know that there probably was a fish biting and they needed to come back and pay attention to the pole. Or maybe you have attached a bell to a cat or some other animal. And that bell on that animal, that pet, allows you to know where that animal is in the house. Or you could have that bell attached to a person, like we have with the high priest. And that bell, I think, among other things, would have allowed the people to realize that as that bell is shaking, as that bell is tingling, that everything is going okay. As long as the bell continues to shake, he is alive. Things are going all right. But if that bell stops, I wonder if he's still alive. Now, you might be thinking, and this would be a natural thought, but it would be a wrong thought. You might be thinking, well, that high priest probably wore those bells on the Day of Atonement. So when he goes into the inner place, the Holy of Holies, the people would know whether or not he was alive or dead. Well, if you were to look back to another place, Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 4, you find that on the Day of Atonement, the high priest had a different set of clothes, if you will, for that day. And nothing is said about bells. So from what I can tell, the bells were not worn on this special day, the Day of Atonement, but they were worn on other days. As you go back and you start looking at some of the Jewish literature, you do find, and this is certainly not biblical, but this is interesting to read from the standpoint of outside material related to the Bible, you do find some sources which talk about on the Day of Atonement, there's some Jews who believe that there was a chain or there was a rope that was attached to the leg of the high priest. The thinking was, for the very reason that I just laid out earlier, if something goes wrong with the guy, we don't want to go in and retrieve him. But if we've got a chain or we've got a rope, then we can go ahead and drag him out, and then we'll obviously take care of the body. But even though that detail is not in the Bible, you can begin to see from Luke chapter 1, the other things that we're looking at, this was scary stuff. These people, as they were thinking about God, as they were thinking about these sacrifices, as they were thinking about the Day of Atonement, we are dealing with the living God. He is a holy God, and we better not foul it up. And then Jesus comes along, and what does he do? Father, 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 Father. That might have been for the Jews one of the strangest things that they heard when Jesus gave that Sermon on the Mount. Now, all that's interesting. But all that information, aside from being interesting, helps set the stage for what I want to look at tonight, and that is the Day of Atonement. When we start digging into this a little bit better, and we especially start looking at the ark, we begin to find some points of comparison. We begin to find some parallels. There were some things associated with this ark that pointed forward to Christ and the New Testament. And there are probably a lot more than I'm able to figure out or offer, but I want to offer at least seven. And one of those things involves propitiation. If you are a Bible reader, you've probably come across that word. Maybe it's been a little while since you've studied that word, but that word propitiation is a big word which simply means that sin can be removed. Propitiation means that a payment has been made for sin and sin can be dealt with. God's anger can be appeased. God's anger can be satisfied. God says you can be in a right relationship with me because of a sacrifice. At times we've talked about the LXX or the Septuagint. The LXX, the Septuagint, is nothing more than a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Now if you were to go back and you were to look at the Septuagint, you would find that, again, remember it's Greek, translating Hebrew, the Hebrew mercy seat is rendered propitiation in the Greek. So you can begin to sort of see a connection there, but there's some other connections as well. Let's begin looking at them. When you go back and you start looking at this mercy seat, you find from the Old Testament that it not just covered the ark as far as the top, it completely covered the ark. Back in Exodus chapter 37, verses 6 through 8, you begin to find some specific details for this lid, the top of the ark. God said that there was to be a single sheet of gold used for the top of the ark. He said, I want it to be a single piece of gold. And that single piece of gold was used to construct the seat area, the top or the lid. And then as we've seen from the pictures, as we can see from this picture, God said on each end, I want you to have a cherubim. You know, they're going to face each other and they're going to be looking down that we've discussed. And he says, these two cherubim, here's a little footnote, God says, I want them to be made from that single piece of gold. So you've got this gold top, and from that gold top, God says you also, from that one piece of gold, you also have to fabricate, you also have to build into that one sheet of gold two cherubim. Now, I'm no craftsman by any stretch of the imagination. And maybe there would be some people who deal with gold and some other things, and they would look at that and they'd say, oh, hey, you know, if we were dealing with another piece of metal, that would be easy. You know, we could just take one piece and we could shape it all. Maybe that's true for some people, but I suspect that it would be, as far as easier or harder, it would be a lot easier to say, well, we're just going to make a lid, and then we're going to get another piece of metal, and we're going to make a cherubim out of that piece, and then we're going to make another cherubim out of this piece, and then we'll just go ahead and piece it together, rather than saying everything's got to come out one way. Now, if that sounds like skilled craftsmanship needed to be involved, that this was going to be something that was somewhat complicated, that's probably true. And we find that as we look at other passages in the Old Testament, that God provided some people some special skills, special craftsmanship skills to do what was necessary. And here you have, I think, an illustration of why he did that. Why then, based on what we've looked at, based on Exodus 37, 6 through 8, would God say, I want you to make this top area, the lid, and these two cherubim out of a single piece of gold? Well, that's a really good question. The answer to that question, at least in part, comes back to this word translated propitiation. As you can see from the slide, some of the passages here, the New Testament talks about propitiation. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 2 is a classic verse. John says there is a propitiation, there is a sin payment for us, and he says that that sin payment is Jesus Christ. Now, this Old Testament ark, this was a place for propitiation. It didn't do all the things that Jesus did, but this was a place to cover some things. This was a place to at least partially deal with sin. Well, what was that lid on the Old Testament ark covering? Well, there were multiple things in there. We're not going to list them all tonight, but one of the things you may remember was a copy of the Ten Commandments. This mercy seat, this propitiation, this area for payment, it covered the Ten Commandments. Bearing that in mind, and thinking that Jesus is our propitiation, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 2, is there any sense in which Jesus has covered some things up, kept some things out of sight, removed some things? Well, we've already seen him using the word Father in the Sermon on the Mount, but in that same sermon, do you remember that Jesus said something else, looking at Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 18? Jesus said, I came not to destroy the law, but I came to fulfill the law. I came to show people exactly what the Old Testament law was about. You've had some exposure to it. I'm here to give you the full meaning. But Jesus did more than that. With that fulfillment, he took it out of the way. He covered it up, so to speak. And Paul talked about that in the book of Colossians, Colossians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. He said Jesus blotted out that Old Testament way. So when we think about this covering, it did point forward to Christ. It pointed forward to the fact that Jesus was going to cover up that Old Testament system to do away with it. But we not only have some information as far as the covering, We also, as we look at this Old Testament ark, we have some information about the color. And that, of course, is gold. As we noted last time, this mercy seat, it was made out of fine gold. Get rid of the impurities. This is going to be the best of the best. If you have a ring, or you have maybe a necklace that's made of gold, and it is very good gold, you likely know that that gold can be dented. It is well known that jewelers will take other metals and blend that with the gold to make it stronger. Now, if this ark is this precious, if this is the place for Old Testament propitiation, you have to ask the question, why would God use this fine gold, which could be easily dented? From our perspective, that might not make a lot of sense. But if you think about what we just learned as far as the propitiation, all of a sudden you can begin to fill in some of the dots. Who is Jesus? He's our high priest. He is our perfect propitiation. He is the ultimate offering for sin. He was, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22, he was the one who was without guile. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 says he was tempted in all points as we are, yet he was without sin. The golden lid, so to speak, the golden pot, box, ultimately pointed forward, we might say, to the golden man. It was this gold that pointed forward to the fact that there would be this perfect offering one day, and that would be Christ. The Jews couldn't see that. Peter talks about how the angels even struggled to understand some of what was going on. But at the right time, Jesus is sent into the world, and little by little, this information is unfolded. As we begin to try to unfold some of the things that are associated with the tabernacle and the ark and now the mercy seat, it's hard to get past the cherubim. Let's go back there for just a second. If you were to read through the book of Hebrews, and there is a lot there as far as Old Testament stuff and how it relates to the new, but you would find in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 5 where the Hebrew writer talks about cherubim, but he adds a little word. He says these cherubim are glorious creatures. Now, I'm sure that all the angels are glorious, but the word glory is specifically associated with the cherubim. Why say Hebrews 9:5 that these cherubim were glorious? Well, if this box had angels and glory, and they were pointing forward to Christ in the New Testament, that would make sense. When we think about Jesus, he certainly is glorious. When we start looking at the cherubim, we begin to find some additional points as well. These cherubim, they are pictured, and even though they are, shall we say, statues, they're not living, they are pictured as looking for a payment for sin. They understand that sin is a real problem, and they're looking for that. God, your righteousness demands judgment or payment. Is payment going to be made? And once a year, every year, a payment is offered. Well, Jesus shows up about 2,000 years ago, and what do you find? You remember that story? Oh, in a couple months, people are going to be talking a lot about Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. Jesus shows up. The shepherds are out there in the field. And guess who shows up? Angels. And you remember, this is in Luke chapter 2 and verse 14. Do you remember the point of emphasis in the message which is being preached by those angels? They said, what has come? Judgment's come. No. What do they preach? Peace. Do you remember that from Luke chapter 2 and verse 14? Here these cherubim, they were looking for judgment. There has to be judgment, God, because of sin. It's only this once a year offering. Oh, something better is coming. And finally he comes into the world. And the angels begin to understand, apparently, that we can see now the plan unfolding. Now that Old Testament for the Jews, that must not have seemed like a very peaceful system. God is infrequently referred to as Father. But when Jesus begins to show up, all of a sudden now, the cat is beginning to get out of the bag. And the angels and the glory, you begin to see them on other occasions as well. You may remember that from Matthew chapter 26 and verse 53, Jesus said, are angels needed to deliver me from this hour? The Father can send down literally legions of angels. Matthew chapter 28 and verse 2, we read about an angel showing up and rolled away the stone. Acts chapter 1 verses 10 and 11, the apostles were promised that angels would return with the Lord at the end of time. We have, as far as Luke chapter 16, what was referenced earlier, the righteous people die, angels escort them to paradise. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, angels will return at the end of time. Angels and Jesus go together, New Testament, angels and what pointed forward to Christ go together in the Old Testament as well. As we think about the Old Testament mercy seat, comparison number 4, approaching God through the seat. Back in Exodus chapter 25, you can see especially, I think this in verse 22, but starting back in verse 17, God said, it is at the mercy seat that Moses, I'm going to commune with you. There is the place of propitiation, and at the place where the payment is being made, that's the spot where I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to give you information. Well, if that mercy seat points forward to Jesus Christ, then would we not expect that when it comes to Jesus, he would be the focal point for religious communication from God? That would be a natural conclusion, and that is exactly what we find. You may remember from Matthew chapter 17, Jesus said, hear ye him. And that is exactly right. This also, I think, helps explain why Colossians chapter 3 and verse 17 is so important. Preachers for many, many years have talked about doing all in the name of Jesus Christ by his authority, and that is right. The Old Testament mercy seat shows us why that is so necessary, why that is so essential. This is, as far as Christ, he is the gateway to the Father. He is the one, his sacrifice allows us to have access to God. And if we're not acting by his authority, we're on some other authority. The authority of some man, the authority of ourselves, whatever that might be. But we are acting without divine authority, and we are in the wrong place to receive God's mercy. If we comply with God's will, that path to mercy is fully open. If we don't, it is fully closed. Someone has said, and I'm not sure who came up with this, it's probably been said by multiple people, but if you look at the Old Testament, especially as you look at Old Testament cities, there were only two types of ways to get into an Old Testament city. One way was to breach the wall. If you want to go against one of the fortified cities, you have to break through the wall. But there was another way, and the other way was the easy way. The other way was you're allowed to go in through the city gate. That's precisely what we have in the New Testament. Jesus uses that very imagery in John chapter 10. He says, if you try to climb up some other way, if you try to breach the wall, if you try to bust into God's kingdom spiritually, you will be stopped every single time. Got the cherubim. You're not going to make it. But Jesus said, if you are willing to use me as the door, if you're willing to use me as the gate, come on in. It works every single time. Paul deals with that in the Corinthian letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 17 through 21 as well. When you go back and you start looking at Exodus chapter 25, verses 17 through 22, you find something else. God says it is at the place of propitiation, it is at the mercy seat, where God said to Moses, I am going to reveal my mind. Now, if you were to look at that passage and you knew nothing about the New Testament, you might think, well, that's kind of interesting and maybe that's kind of odd. But if you take that fact and you look at it in view of the New Testament, God says, the place of propitiation, that is the place where I'm going to declare, that's the place where I'm going to make known my mind. We can see the point of application. Jesus is our propitiation, and it is through Christ that we know the mind of God. Jesus said in John chapter 14 and verse 9, if you have seen me, you've seen the Father. A lot of people say, well, I want to see God. I want to have an experience with God. We find that experience, we find that knowledge through the Bible. Again, Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. God has made known his will in various ways, at various times, through various people. But the Bible says the end of these days has come. Now he makes known that will through Jesus Christ. And Matthew 17, verses 1 through 5, also complementary. When you go back and you start looking at that Old Testament mercy seat, you find that that was the place where some prayers and offerings were made to God. And now we do that very same thing through Jesus Christ. Once a year, just once a year, the high priest came in and put blood on the mercy seat. Jesus comes along, and what's he do? He says, I am the ultimate fulfillment of that. There is no literal seat. I'm going to go to the cross, and I'm going to shed my blood. It is going to be a one-time event, and it's going to last for the entire Christian dispensation. It's going to help people. And one of the ways I think that we see that illustrated so well is when you start looking at the Old Testament high priest, once he goes into the holy place, there's no place for him to sit down. When he's in there, he has to work. But when the true propitiation, when the full propitiation comes and offers himself, pays the price with his blood, what does the Bible say? He sat down. Not true for the Old Testament. It is true for the New Testament. When you start looking at this ark, you find in an overwhelming way that sin is a frightening problem. It is a terrifying problem. At least that's what God says. And it left those Jews wanting for something more. Can you imagine being involved with a religion where you're not sure if your leader is going to live or die? That would not be a very fun faith. Who's going to drag him out if he dies today? How are we going to get him out if God decides to kill him? That would be a frightful religion. But Jesus comes and says, there is a way, there is a new way, there is a living way. And it is a way where you can have God as your father. He will love you as a son. He will treat you as a child who has been adopted into his family, and you will be a full-fledged son. The New Testament is beautiful. It is marvelous from so many perspectives, but especially from the Old Testament. And yet there are people who never come to understand what the Old Testament was talking about or what the New Testament offers. Tonight, if you have at least a smidgen of understanding as far as what God offers, treasure that, hold to that, cling to that, keep that, and one day enjoy the glory that's associated with that. If you're not yet a Christian, tonight there is this marvelous system that God has put into place. It's for me, it's for you, it's for all people. And it is a system which is almost beyond comprehension. And the Bible simply says, come. All are welcome. Tonight, if we can help you come and become a child of God, we let us know how we can do that or how we can encourage you as a Christian as we stand and sing.